was more suitable for her uniform jacket and trousers. And the stink of swamp water had been replaced by the more familiar and more easily tolerable smell of recycled air. But the tiny spaces, which when she had first come to Justice of Torin had excited pride in her assignment and anticipation of what the future might hold, now seemed to trap and confine her. She was tense and unhappy. Esk Decade Commander Tiond sat in her tiny office. It held only two chairs and a desk close against one wall, barely more than a shelf, and space for perhaps two more people to stand. "Lieutenant On has returned," I said to her, and to 100 Captain Rubrin on the command deck. The shuttle docked with a thunk. Captain Rubrin frowned. She had been surprised and dismayed at the news of Lieutenant On's sudden return. The order had come directly from Anander Mianai, who was not to be questioned. Along with it had come orders not to ask what had happened. In her office on the Esk deck, Commander Tiond sighed, closed her eyes, and said, "Tea." She sat silent till Tuesk brought her a cup and a flask, poured, and set both at the commander's elbow. "She'll see me at her earliest convenience." One Esk's attention was mostly on Lieutenant On, threading her way through the lift and the narrow white corridors that would take her to the Esk Decade, to her own quarters. I read relief when she found those corridors empty, except for two Esk. "Commander Tiond will see you at your earliest convenience," I said to Lieutenant On, transmitting directly to her. She acknowledged with a brief twitch of her fingers as she entered the Esk corridors. Tuesk vacated the deck, filing down the corridor to the hold and its waiting suspension pods, and one Esk took up whatever tasks Tuesk had been doing, and also followed Lieutenant On. Above, on medical, a tech medic began to lay out what she needed to replace one Esk's missing segment. At the door of her own small quarters, the same that more than 1,000 years before had belonged to Lieutenant Savardin, Lieutenant On turned to say something to the segment that followed her and then stopped.
"What?"
she asked after an instant.
"Something's wrong. What is it?"
"Please excuse me, Lieutenant," I said. "In the next few minutes, the tech medic will connect a new segment. I might be unresponsive for a short while."
"Unresponsive," she said, feeling momentarily overwhelmed for some reason I couldn't quite understand.
And then, guilty and angry. She stood before the unopened door of her quarters, took two breaths, and then turned and went back down the corridor toward the lift. A new segment's nervous system has to be more or less functional for the hookup. They'd tried it in the past with dead bodies and failed. The same with fully sedated bodies. The connection was never made properly. Sometimes the new segment is given a tranquilizer, but sometimes the tech medic prefers to thaw the new body out and tie it down quickly without any sedation at all. This eliminates the chancy step of sedating just the right amount, but it always makes for an uncomfortable hookup. This particular tech medic didn't care much about my comfort. She wasn't obliged to care, of course. Lieutenant On entered the lift that would bring her to medical, just as the tech medic triggered the release on the suspension pod that held the body. The lid swung up, and for a hundredth of a second, the body lay still and icy within its pool of fluid. The tech medic rolled the body out of the pod onto a neighboring table, the fluid sliding and sheeting off it, and in the same moment it awoke, convulsive, choking and gagging. The preserving medium slides out of the throat and lungs easily on its own,
but the first few times, the experience is a discomfiting one. Lieutenant On exited the lift, strode down the corridor toward medical, with 1-ESC-18 close behind her. The tech medic went swiftly to work, and suddenly I was on the table. I was walking behind Lieutenant On. I was taking up the mending 2-ESC had set down on its way to the holds. I was laying myself down on my small, close bunks. I was wiping a counter in the decade room. And I could see and hear, but I had no control of the new body, and its terror raised the heart rates of all 1-ESC segments. The new segment's mouth opened, and it screamed, and in the background, it heard laughter. I flailed. The binding came loose, and I rolled off the table, fell a meter and a half to the floor with a painful thud. Don't. Don't, don't, I thought at the body. But it wasn't listening. It was sick, it was terrified, it was dying. It pushed itself up and crawled, dizzy. Where, it didn't care, so long as it got away. Then hands under my arms. Elsewhere, 1-ESC was motionless, urging me up. And Lieutenant On. Help, I croaked. Not in Radchai. Damn medic pulled out a body without a decent voice. Help me. It's all right, Lieutenant On shifted her grip, put her arms around the new segment, pulled me in closer. It was shivering, still cold from suspension and from terror. It's all right. It'll be all right. The segment gasped and sobbed for what seemed forever, and I thought maybe it was going to throw up until... The connection clicked home, and I had control of it. I stopped the sobbing. There, said Lieutenant On, horrified, sick to her stomach. Much better. I saw that she was newly angry, or perhaps this was another edge of the distress I'd seen since the temple. Don't injure my unit, Lieutenant On said curtly. And I realized that though she was still looking at me, she was talking to the tech medic. I didn't, Lieutenant, answered the tech medic with a trace of scorn in her voice. They'd had this conversation at greater and more acrimonious length during the annexation. The medic had said, It's not like it's human. It's been in the hold 1,000 years. It's nothing but a part of the ship. Lieutenant On had complained to Commander Tiond, who hadn't understood Lieutenant On's anger, and said so. But thereafter I hadn't dealt with that particular medic. If you're so squeamish, the medic continued, maybe you're in the wrong place. Lieutenant On turned, angry, and left the room without saying anything further. I turned and walked back to the table with some trepidation. The segment was already resisting, and I knew that this tech medic wouldn't care if it hurt when she put in my armor and the rest of my implants. Things were always a bit clumsy while I got used to a new segment. It would occasionally drop things, or fire off disorienting impulses. Random jolts of fear or nausea. Things always seemed off-kilter for a bit, but after a week or two it would usually settle down. Most of the time, anyway. Sometimes a segment simply would not function properly, and then it would have to be removed and replaced. They screen the bodies, of course, but it's not perfect. The voice wasn't the sort I preferred, and it didn't know any interesting songs. Not ones I didn't already know, anyway. I still can't shake the slight and definitely irrational suspicion that the tech medic chose that particular body just to annoy me. After a quick bath in which I assisted, and a change into a clean uniform, Lieutenant On presented herself to Commander Tiond.
On!
The Decade Commander waved Lieutenant On to the opposite chair.
I'm glad to have you back, of course.
Thank you, sir,
said Lieutenant On, sitting.
I didn't expect to see you so soon. I was sure you'd be downside for a while longer.
Lieutenant On didn't answer. Commander Tiond waited for 5 seconds in silence and then said,
I would ask what happened, but I'm ordered not to.
Lieutenant On opened her mouth, took a breath to speak, stopped. Surprised. I had said nothing to her about the orders not to ask what had happened. Corresponding orders to Lieutenant On not to tell anyone hadn't come. A test, I suspected, which I was quite confident Lieutenant On would pass.
Bad?
Asked Commander Tiond, wanting very much to know more, pushing her luck asking even that much.
Yes, sir.
Lieutenant On looked down at her gloved hands, resting in her lap.
Very. Your fault?
Everything on my watch is my responsibility, isn't it, sir?
Yes, Commander Tiond acknowledged. But I'm having trouble imagining you doing anything improper.
The word was weighted in Rodchai, part of a triad of justice, propriety, and benefit. Using it, Commander Tiond implied more than just that she expected Lieutenant On to follow regulations or etiquette. Implied, she suspected some injustice was behind events. Though she could certainly not say so plainly. She possessed none of the facts of the matter and surely didn't wish to give anyone the impression she did. And if Lieutenant On were to be punished for some breach, she wouldn't want to have publicly taken Lieutenant On's part, no matter what her private opinion. Commander Tiond sighed, perhaps out of frustrated curiosity.
Well, she continued with feigned cheerfulness, now you've got plenty of time to catch up on gym time. And you're way behind on renewing your marksmanship certification.
Lieutenant On forced a humorless smile. There had been no gym in Orrs, nor any place remotely resembling a firing range. Yes, sir.
And, Lieutenant, please don't go up to medical unless you really need to.
I could see Lieutenant On wanted to protest, to complain, but that, too, would have been a repeat of an earlier conversation.
Yes, sir. Dismissed.
By the time Lieutenant On finally entered her quarters, it was nearly time for supper. A formal meal, eaten in the decade room in the company of the other ESC lieutenants. Lieutenant On pled exhaustion. No lie, as it happened. She had barely slept 6 hours since she'd left Orrs nearly 3 days before. She sat on her bunk, slumped and staring, until I entered, eased off her boots and took her coat. All right, she said then, closed her eyes and swiveled her legs up onto the bunk. I get the hint. She was asleep 5 seconds after she laid her head down. The next morning, 18 of my 20 ESC lieutenants stood in the decade room, drinking tea and waiting for breakfast. By custom, they couldn't sit without the senior-most lieutenant. The ESC decade room's walls were white, with a blue and yellow border painted just under the ceiling. On one wall, opposite a long counter, were secured various trophies of past annexations. Scraps of two flags, red and black and green. A pink clay roof tile with a raised design of leaves molded into it. An ancient sidearm, unloaded, and its elegantly styled holster. A jeweled gownish mask, an entire window from a Volscian temple, colored glass arranged to form a picture of a woman holding a broom in one hand, 3 small animals at her feet. I remembered taking it out of the wall myself and carrying it back here. Every decade room on the ship had a window from that same building. The temple's vestments and equipment had been thrown into the street, or found their way to other decade rooms on other ships. It was normal practice to absorb any religion the Rotch ran across,
to fit its gods into an already blindingly complex genealogy, or to say merely that the supreme, creator deity was Amat under another name and let the rest sort themselves out. Some quirk of Volscian religion made this difficult for them, and the result had been destructive. Among the recent changes in Rach policy, Anander Mianai had legalized the practice of Valsky's insistently separate religion, and the governor of Valsky had given the building back. There had been talk of returning the windows, since we had still at that time been in orbit around Valsky itself, but ultimately they were replaced with copies. Not long after, the decades below Esk were emptied and closed, but the windows still hung on the walls of the empty, dark decade rooms. Lieutenant Isaiah entered, walked straight to the icon of Torin in its corner niche, and lit the incense waiting in the red bowl at the icon's feet. Six officers frowned, and two made a very quiet, surprised murmur. Only Lieutenant Dariot spoke.
"Is On not coming to breakfast?"
Lieutenant Isaiah turned toward Lieutenant Dariot, showed an expression of surprise that didn't, so far as I could tell, mirror her actual feelings, and said, "Amat's grace, I completely forgot On was back." At the back of the group, safely shielded from Lieutenant Isaiah's view, one very junior lieutenant cast a look at another very junior lieutenant. "It's been so very quiet," Lieutenant Isaiah continued. "It's difficult to believe she is back." "Silence and cold ashes," quoted the junior lieutenant, who had received the other's meaningful glance, more daring than her companion. The poem quoted was an elegy for someone whose funeral offerings had been deliberately neglected. I saw Lieutenant Isaiah react with an instant of ambivalence. The next line spoke of food offerings not made for the dead, and the junior lieutenant conceivably might have been criticizing Lieutenant On for not coming to supper the night before or breakfast on time this morning.
"It really is one-esque," said another lieutenant, concealing her smirk at the very junior lieutenant's cleverness, looking closely at the segments that were at the moment laying out plates of fish and fruit on the counter.
"Maybe On broke it of its bad habits. I hope so."
"Why so quiet, One?" asked Lieutenant Dariot.
"Oh, don't get it started," groaned another lieutenant. "It's too early for all that noise."
"If it was On, good for her," said Lieutenant Isaiah. "A little late, though."
"Like now," said a lieutenant at Lieutenant Isaiah's elbow. "Give me food while yet I live."
Another quote, another reference to funeral offerings, and a rebuttal in case the junior lieutenant had intended insult in the wrong direction.
"Is she coming or not? If she isn't coming, she should say so."
At that moment, Lieutenant On was in the bath, and I was attending her. I could have told the lieutenants that Lieutenant On would be there soon, but I said nothing, only noted the level and temperature of the tea in the black glass bowls various lieutenants held, and continued to lay out breakfast plates. Near my own weapons storage, I cleaned my 20 guns so I could stow them, along with their ammunition. In each of my lieutenants' quarters, I stripped the linen from their beds. The officers of Amat, Torin, Atrepa, and Bo were all well into breakfast, chattering, lively. The captain ate with the decade commanders, a quieter, more sober conversation. One of my shuttles approached me. Four Bo lieutenants returning from leave, strapped into their seats, unconscious. They would be unhappy when they woke.
"Ship," said Lieutenant Dariot. "Will Lieutenant On be joining us for breakfast?"
"Yes, Lieutenant," I said, with 1S6's voice. In the bath, I poured water over Lieutenant On, who stood, eyes closed, on the grating over the drain. Her breathing was even, but her heart rate was slightly elevated, and she showed other signs of stress. I was fairly sure her tardiness was deliberate, designed to give her the bath to herself. Not because she couldn't handle Lieutenant Isaiah, she certainly could, but because she was still distressed from the past day's events.
When? Asked Lieutenant Isaiah, frowning just slightly.
About 5 minutes, Lieutenant. A chorus of groans went up.
Now, Lieutenants, Lieutenant Isaiah admonished, she is our senior, and we should all have patience with her right now. Such a sudden return, when we all thought the Divine would never agree to her leaving Oars.
Found out she wasn't such a good choice, eh?
Sneered the lieutenant at Lieutenant Isaiah's elbow. She was close to Lieutenant Isaiah in more than one sense. None of them knew what had happened and couldn't ask, and I, of course, had said nothing.
Not likely, said Lieutenant Dariot, her voice a shade louder than usual.
She was angry.
Not after 5 years.
I took the tea flask, turned from the counter, went over to where Lieutenant Dariot stood, and poured 11 millimeters of tea into the nearly full bowl she held.
You like Lieutenant Awn, of course, said Lieutenant Isaiah. We all do, but she doesn't have breeding. She wasn't born for this. She works so very hard at what comes naturally to us. I would hardly be surprised if 5 years was all she could take without cracking.
She looked at the empty bowl in her gloved hand.
I need more tea.
You think you'd have done a better job in Awn's place, observed Lieutenant Dariot.
I don't trouble myself with hypotheticals, answered Lieutenant Isaiah. The facts are what they are. There's a reason Awn was senior-esque lieutenant long before any of us got here. Obviously, Awn has some ability or she'd never have done as well as she has, but she's reached her limit.
A quiet murmur of agreement.
Her parents are cooks, Lieutenant Isaiah continued. I'm sure they're excellent at what they do. I'm sure she would manage a kitchen admirably.
Three lieutenants snickered. Lieutenant Dariot said, her voice tight and edged,
Really?
Finally dressed, uniform as perfect as I could make it, Lieutenant Awn stepped out of the dressing room into the corridor, 5 steps away from the decade room. Lieutenant Isaiah noticed Lieutenant Dariot's mood with a familiar ambivalence. Lieutenant Isaiah was senior, but Lieutenant Dariot's house was older, wealthier than Lieutenant Isaiah's, and Lieutenant Dariot's branch of that house were direct clients to a prominent branch of Mianai itself. Theoretically, that didn't matter here.
Theoretically.
All the data I received from Lieutenant Isaiah that morning had had an underlying taste of resentment, which grew momentarily stronger.
Managing a kitchen is a perfectly respectable job, said Lieutenant Isaiah. But I can only imagine how difficult it must be to be bred to be a servant and instead of taking an assignment that truly suits, to be thrust into a position of such authority. Not everyone is cut out to be an officer.
The door opened and Lieutenant Awn stepped in just as the last sentence left Lieutenant Isaiah's mouth. Silence engulfed the decade room. Lieutenant Isaiah looked calm and unconcerned, but felt abashed. She had clearly not intended, would never have dared, to say such things openly to Lieutenant Awn. Only Lieutenant Dariot spoke.
Good morning, Lieutenant.
Lieutenant Awn didn't answer, didn't even look at her, but went to the corner of the room where the decade shrine sat, with its small figure of Torin and bowl of burning incense. Lieutenant Awn made her obeisance to the figure and then looked at the bowl with a slight frown. As before, her muscles were tense, her heart rate elevated, and I knew she guessed at the content, or at least the drift of the conversation before she had entered, knew who it was who wasn't cut out to be an officer. She turned.
"Good morning, Lieutenants. I apologize for having kept you waiting."
And launched without any other preamble into the morning prayer.
"The flower of justice is peace."
The others joined, and when they were finished, Lieutenant Awn went to her place at the head of the table, sat. Before the others had time to settle themselves, I had tea and breakfast in front of her. I served the others, and Lieutenant Awn took a sip of her tea and began to eat. Lieutenant Dariot picked up her utensil.
"It's good to have you back."
Her voice was just slightly edged, only barely managing to conceal her anger.
"Thank you," said Lieutenant Awn, and took another bite of fish.
"I still need tea," said Lieutenant Isaiah.
The rest of the table was tense and hushed, watching.
"The quiet is nice, but perhaps there's been a decline in efficiency."
Lieutenant Awn chewed, swallowed, took another drink of tea.
"Pardon?"
"You've managed to silence one ask," explained Lieutenant Isaiah, "but..."
She raised her empty bowl. At that moment, I was behind her with the flask and poured, filling the bowl. Lieutenant Awn raised one gloved hand, gesturing toward the mootness of Lieutenant Isaiah's point.
"I haven't silenced one ask."
She looked at the segment with the flask and frowned.
"Not intentionally, anyway. Go ahead and sing if you want, one ask."
A dozen lieutenants groaned. Lieutenant Isaiah smiled insincerely. Lieutenant Dariot stopped, a bite of fish halfway to her mouth.
"I like the singing, it's nice, and it's a distinction."
"It's embarrassing is what it is," said the lieutenant close to Lieutenant Isaiah.
"I don't find it embarrassing," said Lieutenant Awn a bit stiffly.
"Of course not," said Lieutenant Isaiah, malice concealed in the ambiguity of her words. "Why so quiet then, one?"
"I've been busy, Lieutenant," I answered, "and I haven't wanted to disturb Lieutenant Awn." "Your singing doesn't disturb me, one," said Lieutenant Awn. "I'm sorry you thought it did. Please sing if you want."
Lieutenant Isaiah raised an eyebrow. "An apology and a please? That's a bit much."
"Courtesy," said Lieutenant Dariot, her voice uncharacteristically prim, "is always proper and always beneficial."
Lieutenant Isaiah smirked. "Thank you, Mother."
Lieutenant Awn said nothing. 4.5 hours after breakfast, the shuttle bearing those 4 second bow lieutenants home from their leave docked. They'd been drinking for 3 days and had continued right up to the moment they left Shiserna Station. The first of them, through the lock, staggered slightly and then closed her eyes.
"Medic,"
she breathed. "They expect you," I said, through the segment of one bow I'd placed there. "Do you need help onto the lift?" The lieutenant made a feeble attempt to wave my offer away and moved off slowly down the corridor, one shoulder against the wall for support. I boarded the shuttle, kicking off past the boundary of my artificially generated gravity. The shuttle was too small to have its own. 2 of the officers, still drunk themselves, were trying to wake the 4th, passed out cold in her seat. The pilot, the most junior of the bow officers, sat stiff and apprehensive. I thought at first her discomfort was due to the reek of spilled arak and vomit. Thankfully, the former had apparently been spilled onto the lieutenants themselves, on Shiserna Station, and nearly all of the latter had gone into the appropriate receptacles. But then I looked, one bow looked, toward the stern and saw 3 Anander Mianais sitting silent and impassive in the rear seats. Not there to me. she would have boarded at Shiserna Station quietly. Told the pilot to say nothing to me. The others had, I suspected, been too intoxicated to notice her. I thought of her asking me on the planet when she had last visited me. Of my inexplicable and reflexive lie. The real last time had been a good deal like this. "My lord," I said when all the bow lieutenants were out of earshot, "I'll notify the 100 captain."
"No," said one Anander. "Your var deck is empty."
"Yes, my lord," I acknowledged.
"I'll stay there while I'm on board."
Nothing further, no why or how long, or when I could tell the captain what I was doing. I was obliged to obey Anander Mianai, even over my own captain. But I rarely had an order from one without the knowledge of the other. It was uncomfortable. I sent segments of one esk to retrieve one var from the hold, started one section of var deck warming. The three Anander Mianais declined my offer of assistance with their luggage, carried their things down to var. This had happened before. At Valsky, my lower decks had been mostly empty because many of my troops had been out of the hold and working. She had stayed on the esk deck that time. What had she wanted then? What had she done? To my dismay, I found my thoughts slipping around the answer, which remained vague, invisible. That wasn't right. It wasn't right at all. Between the esk and var decks was direct access to my brain. What had she done at Valsky that I couldn't remember? And what was she preparing to do now?
Chapter 13. Further south, the snow and ice became impermanent, though it was still cold by non-Nilt standards. Nilters regard the equatorial region as a sort of tropical paradise, where grain can actually grow, where the temperature can easily exceed 8 or 9 degrees C. Most of Nilt's large cities are on or near the equatorial ring. The same is true of the planet's one claim to any sort of fame, the glass bridges. These are approximately 5-meter-wide ribbons of black, hanging in gentle catenaries across trenches nearly as wide as they are deep. Dimensions measured in kilometers. No cables, no piers. No trusses. Just the arc of black attached to each cliff face. Fantastic arrangements of colored glass coils and rods hang from the bottoms of the bridges, sometimes projecting sideways. The bridges themselves are, according to all observations, also made of glass, though glass could never possibly withstand the sort of stress these bridges do. Even their own weight should be too much for them, suspended as they are with nothing for support. There are no rails or handholds, just the drop, and at the bottom, kilometers down, a cluster of thick-walled tubes, each one just 1.5 meters wide, empty and smooth-walled. These are made of the same material as the bridges. No one knows what the bridges and the tubes beneath them were for, or who built them. They were here when humans first colonized Nilt. Theories abound, each one less likely than the one before. Interdimensional beings feature prominently in many of them. These either created or shaped humanity for its own purposes, or left a message for humans to decipher for obscure reasons of their own. Or they were evil, bent on destruction of all life. The bridges were somehow part of their plan. Another whole subfield claims the bridges were built by humans, some ancient, long-lost, fantastically advanced civilization that either died out, slowly, pathetically, or spectacularly as the result of some catastrophic mistake, or moved on to a higher level of existence.
Advocates of this sort of theory often make the additional claim that Nilt is, in reality, the birthplace of humans. Nearly everywhere I've been, popular wisdom has it that the location of humanity's original planet is unknown. Mysterious. In fact, it isn't, as anyone who troubles to read on the subject will discover. But it is very, very, very far away from nearly anywhere, and not a tremendously interesting place. Or at the very least, not nearly as interesting as the enchanting idea that your people are not newcomers to their homes, but in fact only recolonized the place they had belonged from the beginning of time. One meets this claim anywhere one finds a remotely human-habitable planet. The bridge outside Therid wasn't much of a tourist attraction. Most of the jewel-bright arabesques of glass had shattered over thousands of years, leaving it nearly plain. And Therid is still too far north for non-Milters to endure comfortably. Off-world visitors generally confine themselves to the better-preserved bridges on the equator. Buy a Bove hair blanket, guaranteed hand-spun and hand-woven by masters of the craft, in the unbearably cold reaches of the world, though these are almost certainly turned out on machines, by the dozen, a few kilometers from the gift shop. Choke down a few fetid swallows of fermented milk, and return home to regale their friends and associates with tales of their adventure. All this I learned within a few minutes of knowing I would need to visit Nilt to achieve my aim. Therid sat on a broad river, chunks of green and white ice bobbing and crashing in its current, the first boats of the season already moored at the docks. On the opposite side of the city, the dark slash of the bridge's huge trough made a definitive stop to the straggling edge of houses. The southern edge of the city was flyer parks, then a wide complex of blue and yellow painted buildings that was, by the look of it, a medical facility, one that must have been the largest of its kind in the area. It was surrounded by squares of lodgings and food shops and swaths of houses, bright pink, orange, yellow, red, in stripes and zigzags and crosshatches. We had flown half the day. I might have flown all night, I was capable of it, though it would have been unpleasant. But I saw no need for haste. I sat down in the first empty space I found, told Savardin curtly to get out, and did so myself. I shouldered my pack, paid the parking fee, disabled the flyer, as I had at Striegan's, and set off toward the city, not looking to see if Savardin followed. I had sat down near the medical facility. The lodgings surrounding it were some of them luxurious, but many were smaller and less comfortable than the one I'd rented in the village where I'd found Savardin, though a bit more expensive. Bright-coated southerners came and went, speaking a language I didn't understand. Others spoke the one I knew, and fortunately, this was the same language the signs used. I chose lodging, roomier, at least, than the suspension pod-size holes that were the cheapest available, and took Savardin off to the first clean-looking and moderately priced food shop I could find. When we entered, Savardin eyed the shelves of bottles on the far wall.
"They have arrak."
"It'll be incredibly expensive," I said, "and probably not very good. They don't make it here. Have a beer instead." She had been showing some signs of stress and wincing slightly at the profusion of bright colors, so I expected some sort of irritable outburst, but instead she merely gestured acquiescence. Then she wrinkled her nose, slight disgust.
"What do they make beer out of here?"
"Grain. It grows nearer the equator. It's not as cold there." We found seats on the benches that lined three rows of long tables, and a waiter brought us beer and bowls of something she told us was the house specialty.
"Extra beautiful eating, yes," she said, in a badly mangled approximation of Radchai,
and it was, in fact, quite good, and turned out to have actual vegetables in it.
a good proportion of thinly sliced cabbage, among whatever the rest of it was. The smaller lumps appeared to be meat, probably bove. Savardin cut one of the larger lumps in two with her spoon, revealing plain white. "Probably cheese," I said. She grimaced.
"Why can't these people eat real food? Don't they know better?"
"Cheese is real food, so is cabbage."
"But this sauce..."
"Tastes good." I took another spoonful.
"This whole place smells funny," she complained.
"Just eat." She looked dubiously at her bowl, scooped a spoonful, sniffed it. "It can't possibly smell worse than that fermented milk drink," I said. She actually half smiled.
"No."
I took another spoonful, pondering the implications of this better behavior. I wasn't sure what it meant. About her state of mind, about her intentions, about who or what she thought I was. Maybe Striegen had been right, and Savardin had decided the most profitable course, for now, was to not alienate the person who was feeding her, and that would change as soon as her options changed. A high voice called out from another table.
"Hello?"
I turned. The girl with the tick-tick set waved to me from where she sat with her mother. For an instant I was surprised, but we were near the medical center, where I knew they had brought their injured relative, and they had come from the same direction we had, and so they had likely parked on the same side of town. I smiled and nodded, and she got up and came to where we were sitting.
"Your friend is better," she said brightly.
"That's good. What are you eating?"
"I don't know," I admitted. "The waiter said it was the house specialty."
"Oh, that's very good. I had it yesterday. When did you get here? It's so hot, it's like summer already. I can't imagine what it's like further north."
Clearly, she'd had time to recover her more usual spirits since the accident that had brought her to Striegen's house. Savardin, spoon in hand, watched her, bemused. "We've been here an hour," I said. "We're only stopping for the night, on our way to the ribbon."
"We're here until Uncle's legs are better, which will probably be another week."
She frowned, counting days.
"A little longer. We're sleeping in our flyer, which is terribly uncomfortable, but Mama says the price for lodging here is outright theft."
She sat down on the end of the bench next to me.
"I've never been in space. What's it like?"
"It's very cold. Even you would find it cold." She thought that was funny, gave a little laugh. "And of course there's no air, and hardly any gravity, so everything just floats." She frowned at me, mock rebuke.
"You know what I mean."
I glanced over to where her mother sat, stolid, eating, unconcerned. "It's really not very exciting." The girl made a gesture of indifference.
"Oh, you like music. There's a singer at a place down the street tonight."
She used the word I had used mistakenly, not the one she had corrected me with in Striegen's house.
"We didn't go to hear her last night because they charge. And besides, she's my cousin. Or she's in the next lineage over from mine, and she's my mother's cousin's daughter's aunt. That's close enough, anyway. I heard her at the last ingather. She's very good."
"I'll be sure to go. Where is it?" She gave me the name of the place, and then said she had to finish her supper. I watched her go back to her mother, who only looked up briefly and gave a curt nod, which I returned. The place the girl had named was only a few doors down. A long, low-ceilinged building, its back wall all shutters, open just now on a walled yard, where Nilter sat uncoated in the 1 degree air drinking beer, listening silently to a woman playing a bowed stringed instrument I'd never seen before. I quietly ordered beer for myself and Savardin, and we took seats on the inner side of the shutters, slightly warmer than the yard for the lack of a breeze, and with a wall to put our backs against. A few people turned to look at us, stared a moment, then turned away more or less politely. Savardin leaned 3 centimeters in my direction and whispered, "Why are we here?"
"To hear the music."
She raised an eyebrow. "This is music?" I turned to look at her directly. She flinched, just slightly.
"Sorry, it's just..."
She gestured helplessly. "Rodchai do have stringed instruments, quite a variety of them, in fact, accrued through several annexations. But playing them in public is considered a slightly risque act, because one has to play either barehanded or in gloves so thin as to be nearly pointless. And this music, the long, slow, uneven phrases that made its rhythms difficult for the Rodchai ear to hear, the harsh, edged tone of the instrument, wasn't what Savardin had been brought up to appreciate.
"It's so..."
A woman at a nearby table turned and made a reproving shushing noise. I gestured conciliation and turned a cautioning look on Savardin. For a moment, her anger showed in her face, and I was sure I would have to take her outside. But she took a breath and looked at her beer and drank, and afterward looked steadily ahead in silence. The piece ended, and the audience rapped fists gently on their tables. The string player somehow looked both impassive and gratified, and launched into another. This one noticeably faster, and loud enough for Savardin to safely whisper to me again.
"How long are we going to be here?"
"A while," I said.
"I'm tired. I want to go back to the room."
"Do you know where it is?" She gestured assent. The woman at the other table eyed us disapprovingly.
"Go,"
I whispered as quietly as I could and still, I hoped, be heard by Savardin. Savardin left. Not my concern anymore, I told myself, whether she found her way back to our lodgings. And I congratulated myself on having had the foresight to lock my pack in the facilities safe for the night, even without Striegen's warning. I didn't trust Savardin with my belongings or my money, or wandered aimlessly through the city, or walked into the river and drowned. Whatever she did, it was no concern of mine and nothing I needed to worry about. I had, instead, a jar of sufficiently decent beer and an evening of music, with the promise of a good singer and songs I'd never heard before. I was nearer to my goal than I'd ever dared hope to be, and I could, for just this one night, relax. The singer was excellent, though I didn't understand any of the words she sang. She came on late, and by then the place was crowded and noisy, though the audience occasionally fell silent over their beer, listening to the music, and the knocking between pieces grew loud and boisterous. I ordered enough beer to justify my continued presence, but didn't drink most of it. I'm not human, but my body is, and too much would have dulled my reactions unacceptably. I stayed quite late, and then walked back to our lodgings along the darkened street. Here and there a pair or threesome walking, conversing, ignoring me. In the tiny room I found Savardin asleep, motionless, breathing calm, face and limbs slack. Something indefinably still about her suggested that this was the first I'd seen her in real, restful sleep. For the briefest instant, I found myself wondering if she'd taken Kef. But I knew she had no money, didn't know anyone here, and didn't speak any of the languages I had heard so far. I lay down beside her and slept. I woke 6 hours later, and incredibly, Savardin still lay beside me, still asleep. I didn't think she had waked while I slept. She might as well get as much rest as she could. I was, after all, in no hurry. I rose and went out. Further toward the medical center, the street became noisy and crowded. I bought a bowl of hot, milky porridge from a vendor along the side of the walkway, and continued along where the road curved around the hospital and off toward the center of the town. Buses stopped, let passengers off, picked others up, continued on. In the stream of people, I saw someone I recognized, the girl from Striegen's and her mother.
They saw me. The girl's eyes widened, and she frowned slightly. Her mother's expression didn't change, but they both swerved to approach me. They had, it seemed, been watching for me.
"Breck,"
said the girl, when they had stopped in front of me, subdued. Uncharacteristically, it seemed. "Is your uncle all right?" I asked.
"Yes, uncle is fine."
But clearly something troubled her.
"Your friend," said her mother, impassive as always, and stopped.
"Yes?"
"Our flyer is parked near yours," the girl said,
clearly dreading the communication of bad news.
"We saw it when we got back from supper last night."
"Tell me." I didn't enjoy suspense. Her mother actually frowned.
"It's not there now."
I said nothing, waiting for the rest.
"You must have disabled it," she continued. "Your friend took money, and the people who paid him towed the flyer away."
The lot staff must not have questioned it. They had seen Savardin with me. "She doesn't speak any languages," I protested.
"They made lots of motions," explained the girl, gesturing widely. "Lots of pointing and speaking very slow."
I had badly underestimated Savardin. Of course, she had survived, going from place to place with no language but Rodshai and likely no money, but still had managed to nearly overdose on Kef. More than once, likely. She could manage herself, even if she managed badly. She was entirely capable of getting what she wanted without help. And she had wanted Kef, and she had obtained it. At my expense, but that was of no importance to her.
"We knew it couldn't be right," said the girl, "because you said you were only stopping the night on the way to space. But no one would have listened to us. We're just bove herders."
And no doubt the sort of person who would buy a flyer with no documentation, no proof of ownership, a flyer, moreover, that had obviously been deliberately disabled to prevent its being moved by anyone but the owner, it might very well be a good idea to avoid confronting such a person.
"I wouldn't presume to say," said the girl's mother, oblique condemnation, "what sort of friend your friend is."
"Not my friend. Never my friend, now or at any other time. Thank you for telling me." I walked to the lot, and the flyer was indeed gone. When I returned to the room, I found Savardin still sleeping, or at any rate still unconscious. I wondered just how much Kef the flyer had bought her. I only wondered long enough to retrieve my pack from the lodging's safe, pay for the night. After this, Savardin would have to fend for herself, which apparently posed very little problem for her, and went looking for transport out of town. There was a bus, but the first had left 15 minutes before I asked after it, and the next wouldn't leave for 3 hours. A train ran alongside the river, northward once a day, and like the bus, it had already left. I didn't want to wait. I wanted to be gone from here. More specifically, I didn't want to chance seeing Savardin again, even briefly. The temperature here was mostly above freezing, and I was entirely capable of walking long distances. The next town worth the name was, according to maps I'd seen, only a day away. If I cut across the glass bridge and then straight across the countryside instead of following the road which curved to avoid the river and the bridge's wide chasm. The bridge was several kilometers out of town. The walk would do me good. I hadn't had enough exercise lately. The bridge itself might be mildly interesting. I set off toward it. When I had walked a little over half a kilometer, past the lodgings and food shops that surrounded the medical center, into what looked like a residential neighborhood, smaller buildings, groceries, clothes shops, complexes of low square houses joined by covered passageways, Savardin came up behind me.
"Breck," she gasped out of breath.
Where are you going?
I didn't answer, only walked faster.
Breck, damn it!
I stopped, but didn't turn around. Considered speaking. Nothing I thought of saying was remotely temperate, nor would anything I said do any sort of good. Savardin caught up with me.
Why didn't you wake me up?
She asked. Answers occurred to me. I refrained from speaking any of them aloud, and instead began walking again. I didn't look back. I didn't care if she followed me or not. Hoped, in fact, she wouldn't. I could certainly have no continued sense of responsibility, no fears that without me she would be helpless. She could take care of herself.
Breck, damn it!
Savardin called again, and then swore, and I heard her footsteps behind me, and her labored breath again as she caught up. This time I didn't stop, but quickened my pace slightly. After another 5 kilometers, during which she had intermittently fallen behind and then raced, gasping to catch up, she said,
Otters, tits, you hold a grudge, don't you?
Still, I said nothing and didn't stop. Another hour passed. The town well behind us, and the bridge came in sight. Flat black, arcing across the drop, spikes and curls of glass below, brilliant red, intense yellow, ultramarine, and jagged stubs of others. The chasm walls were striated. Black, green, gray, and blue, frosted here and there with ice. Below, the bottom of the chasm was lost in cloud. A sign in 5 languages proclaimed it to be a protected monument. Access permitted only to a certain class of license holders. What license, to what purpose, was mysterious to me, as I didn't recognize all the words on the sign. A low barrier blocked the entrance, nothing I couldn't easily step over, and there was no one here but me and Savardin. The bridge itself was 5 meters wide, like all the others, and while the wind blew strong, it wasn't strong enough to endanger me. I strode forward and stepped over the barrier and out onto the bridge. Had heights troubled me, I might have found it dizzying. Fortunately, they didn't, and my only discomfort was the feeling of open spaces behind and under me that I couldn't see unless I turned my attention away from other places. My boots thunked on the black glass, and the whole structure swayed slightly and shuddered in the wind. A new pattern of vibrations told me Savardin had followed me. What happened next was largely my own fault. We were halfway across when Savardin spoke.
All right, I get it, you're angry.
I stopped but didn't turn. How much did you get? I asked finally, only one of the things I had considered saying.
What?
Though I hadn't turned, I could see the motion as she leaned over, hands on her knees, could hear her still breathing hard, straining to be heard against the wind.
How much kef? I only wanted a little, she said, not quite answering my question. Enough to take the edge off. I need it. And it's not like you paid for that flyer to begin with.
For an instant, I thought she had remembered how I had acquired the flyer, unlikely as that seemed. But she continued.
You've got enough in that pack to buy 10 flyers, and none of it's yours. It belongs to the Lord of the Roch, doesn't it? Making me walk like this is just you being pissy.
I stood, still facing forward, my coat flattened against me in the wind. Stood trying to understand what her words meant, about who or what she thought I was, why she thought I had troubled myself about her.
I know what you are, she said as I stood silent. No doubt you wish you could leave me behind, but you can't, can you? You've got orders to bring me back.
What am I? I asked, still without turning, loud against the wind.
Nobody, that's who.
Savardin's voice was scornful.
She was standing upright now, just behind my left shoulder.
You tested into military, in the aptitudes, and like a million other nobodies these days, you think